Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Recovery Radio broadcast recorded live at the Latar Recovery Center in downtown Moscow. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latar Recovery Center located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latarrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latarrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook.
Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how recovery from addiction and mental health issues affect us all, to make our community aware of the recovery resources available in our area, and to share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experiences, insight, and hope for continuing in recovery. I'm Denise, and I am a grateful believer in Jesus and very glad to be in recovery today. And who are you?
Who am I? Who am I? I am Radio Johnny, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And today we've got a great guest in the studio, and her name is Colleen Turk, and she is the resident part-time counselor at the Latar Recovery Center. And Colleen, welcome.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, Johnny. Thank you, Denise. It's wonderful to be here with you both. Thank you.
We're so glad.
Before we dive into our topic today, why don't you share with our audience a little bit about yourself, where you came from, what made you decide to dive into this counseling world and blah, 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 and et cetera.
All right. I'm finishing up my master's program with Divine Mercy University, and as part of getting your master's in clinical counseling, you do an internship. So the Recovery Center and the Rural Crisis Center Network are gracious enough to provide opportunities for interns to get their hours here. I have supervision from Joyce Lyons. She's with the Idaho Department of Public Health. And then I have Daryl as my boss here for the Recovery Center side of my work. So I'm getting the experience of a lifetime. I do have to say that all of my colleagues are very envious of what I get to do here and the wonderful opportunities between Joyce's supervision and Daryl's. He's just really good at pushing people to do the maximum that they can do and then go beyond even what they thought they could do. So I'm just getting a fantastic experience. And then the client interactions and how much I'm learning about really just sitting with somebody in the space and being entrusted with their stories is it's such an honor. I can't put it into words.
Yeah, I can only imagine. When I deal with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I sponsor men, there has to be a level of trust there. And similar to what you do, people trust me with some of their deepest, darkest secrets. Because in AA, we believe you're really only as sick as your secrets. And that feeling of being honored that somebody looks at you in that way and it feels enough trust to let that really deep stuff go out. That's a fantastic thing. And I know you, Denise, mm-hmm. get into that scenario with people you work with.
I do. And I just think that it's so great. The more space that there is that's a safe environment for people to be able to talk through things and have someone there to listen, maybe ask some open-ended questions or something is kind of what we do. It's just so needed. I think people can get past a lot of roadblocks if they can have somebody who just takes the time to listen.
Mm-hmm.
That's just really great. You just provide such a well-needed service. That's just so great.
Oh, thank you.
We're so glad to have you here.
It's really a pleasure and an honor. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah,
especially in this crazy rural environment mm-hmm. we have. You know, I dealt with some pretty deep, dark depression a few years back, and it was really, really difficult to be able to get in and see somebody. I mean, I had insurance. I was willing, to pay my part as I go. I, was earning good money. But just the availability of a professional, call them up. Oh, yeah, well, we can get you on the wait list. Maybe we can get you in 6 months. But for someone to be able to basically walk in here and have somebody to talk to, maybe just only within a day or so, I mean, I realize you don't work full time, but I know the time that you're here, like this hour we're using up with you right now, is time somebody could really use if they want to take advantage of our, you know, what we have to offer here. So that's part of why you're here today, to, you know, make sure the word is out that the service is available, and come on in and utilize it for sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You suggested a topic when we were talking about having you come on and talk today. And what you suggested is, and I'm quoting, the difference between a trauma-informed lens versus trauma counseling, and how this relates to breaking the stigma and having healthier communities. I have no idea what that is, but it sounds fascinating, especially the part about breaking the stigma. I'm guessing we're talking about the stigma of people with mental health issues in society.
Correct, yes.
So why don't you dive in? Tell us about the difference between trauma-informed lenses and trauma counseling.
Sure. Well, both of you have actually alluded in your own way a little bit to seeing people through a trauma-informed lens. So the work that you do in AA, and when you sit with people and they share their stories with you, and Denise, when you help people the way that you help people and the way that you just described, both of you, to me, I felt like you are sitting with people in a trauma-informed way. And to me, what that means is understanding that everybody is doing the best they can at that time X in their lives with the tools that they have. So a trauma-informed lens is really more at the societal and environmental level. What does that mean, doing the best they can with the tools that they have, and how does that relate to breaking the stigma? And I think here's just a thought experiment for that, just really briefly. If both of you can just think of someone you know, usually somebody that you're in pretty close day-to-day interaction with, work or home or school, somebody who is an annoyance to you at this time in your life, somebody who's frustrating, annoying, doesn't have the same goals as you, or is trying to go about things in just an annoying way, but somebody who's just a pain in your butt right now. And I don't want to do any couples counseling as a result of this, but whoever comes to mind is fine. So if you can think of that person through the lens of somebody who is trying to meet some need. So what neuroscience has shown us is that what people really need is to feel safe in their space, and it's all psychological, emotional. Not that the bottom layer of Maslow's triangle doesn't matter, but let's assume that we're talking about people whose basic needs are being met.
Right.
So this is someone who's just kind of a pain in your neck for some more psychological, emotional, or they're just not on the same page as you type reason. If you can think of that person as somebody who has an unmet need, and you can think, well, their toolkit might be different than mine. Maybe I would deal with it like this, but their toolkit is different, and they're dealing with it the best they can. Just having that understanding and awareness, it changes the way you talk to people. It changes your tone. It helps them theoretically, and often what research has shown is it just helps them. That feeling of safety helps them show up as their best self moment to moment, and then they're helping. It's each of you are kind of helping each other then in that interpersonal way that we're kind of made to do. We're really kind of wired for interpersonal relationships, and we thwart people when they're annoying us, honestly, and then that thwarts our own growth too. So the more compassion you have for somebody else, the more you're actually going to start having compassion for yourself. This, I feel like this just kind of spreads more and more into society, the more we have that kind of empathy for people, that they're really just trying to get some need met. Maybe it's for affirmation. Maybe it's validation. Maybe it's a loneliness thing or a fear of abandonment or something. Not that you have to put that into words and talk about it. In fact, oftentimes it's not helpful to do that. But sometimes to just know that just changes the way you interact with people. That's the trauma-informed lens. And then similarly to what we do in counseling, you can be curious. You know, you can ask a person, how can I help you? And that's different than, do you need help? You know, things that have a yes or no response usually aren't as effective as, how can I help you? It just sounds more humble. It sounds more like, I get it, we all struggle, how can I help you? You know what I mean? Without having to say that first part. It's more respectful. It's just acknowledging we're all human, right? And we could all use some help.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right. I've heard a question posed as, rather than what's wrong with you,
mm-hmm.
as a better form of that question is, what happened to you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it gives, you know, like Denise was saying, the open-ended question.
Mm-hmm.
The question that just doesn't demand the yes or no. I can't tell you how many times I've been dealing with people that I know are in a bad space, and you ask them, how are you? And they say, fine.
Like,
and
everyone.
There's an acronym for that that's filthy, and I can't say it on the radio. But something about something indifferent and non-whatever. But basically, for me, that's a huge red flag. It says, no, things are not fine.
Mm-hmm.
It says, I don't want to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
or you wouldn't understand, or, you know, anything along those lines. It's a big roadblock that goes up.
Yeah.
But if you ask somebody, what's going on? Did something happen today? Or even saying, you know, you seem kind of sad today. What can I help? It's the approach makes all the difference in the world on how somebody might respond to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my experience.
And I've heard, like, over and over again, people at Restoration Night or CR will say, yeah, people ask how I'm doing, but they don't really want to know. Because we do, you know, pass by people, how are you, I'm good, I'm okay, that
right,
kind of thing.
Right.
But just making sure that if you can, if you want to talk further with someone, like, there's a different way, like what you're saying, to be able to let them know, no, I really do want to know how you're doing. And even then, you know, I have relationships or know people that then they know they have permission always, mm-hmm. to talk with me and share if they need to. You know, and there just are times sometimes when we're just passing by people that we just say, how are you? And it's just okay. And, you know.
Right. Right. Just
but
that friendly.
Yeah. I find, so, though, if you don't have people that are in your life that you can do that with, like, take time to talk with them.
Yeah.
Life's hard.
Right. And sometimes, you know? It is the people that we are most connected with. They are at work or school or home or, mm-hmm. something like that. And sometimes we do have the time for them.
Mm-hmm.
Those, you know, those are the people that we do have time for. So it is a matter of just being compassionate and humble, basically, and just realizing that they're struggling in their way, I struggle in my way. Johnny, you used the word understand. You said that sometimes people feel like you wouldn't understand. And I want to just go there for a second.
Sure.
Because one thing that research has shown is actually really injurious to people is when you say, oh, I went through the same thing. I completely understand. Even if you did go through something really similar, let's say two people have experienced divorce, two people have experienced loss of a child or something like that. Let's say two moms have lost a 7-year-old daughter. Oh my goodness, I know exactly how you feel. No, you don't. What if one of them lost her 7-year-old daughter because she was driving drunk and got the car in an accident? The other one lost her child to a drunk driver. You do not know. You don't. You really don't know the variables in somebody else's life. So to do your best and to say, I'll do my best to understand and I'll be here with you and I'll go through this with you, but I don't know that I can really understand the level of pain that you're experiencing right now. So again, it's a little bit more of a humble approach, you know, that not knowing, that curiosity, I really don't know, but I'm here to hear it.
Right. There's kind of a unwritten understanding amongst AAs, and I experience it all the time. I'll bump into one of the fellows at a grocery store, for instance. This, for some reason, grocery stores are the main meeting place for AAs outside the rooms. And
gotta eat.
Rarely the liquor store, although that did happen to me once. It was kind of funny. We were both in there buying alcohol for our wives for events or something, but it was kind of funny. It's like, what are you doing? Hey, what are you doing? But anyway, there's this kind of code, I guess, that when I see a fellow somewhere and I say, how are you doing? The expectation is they're going to be honest and actually tell me how they're doing. I'm having a crappy day. Mm-hmm. Or I'm having a great day. Things are going real good. How are you? But that's a really unique bond that has to be established over time. Now, I can't imagine in the counseling world. Let's, just for fun, let's run through just a scenario of what you do on a daily basis. So I'll be the client. I come
good
in.
Good luck. Just kidding.
I come into the recovery center, and I talk to Denver over there, and I say, yeah, I hear you have some counseling service, and I'm struggling with something, and I'd like to talk to a counselor. And they hunt you down, and you have some free time. We go through the paperwork or whatever is involved. You would ask me something along the lines of, well, what would you like to talk about, or what's going on? Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, well, you know, I'm just out of joint. I don't know what's going on in my head. It's running like, it's like a squirrel cage. I can't shut it off. I'm not sleeping well. And I just feel lousy all the time.
Okay. So the first thing I'm going to do with you in this situation is, just because you're acting this part really well right now, and so you're actually helping me get right in the mode, is I'm actually going to do some grounding exercises and help you just kind of de-escalate a little bit so that you can access your own mental and emotional resources, and we can actually have a more productive conversation. And I'm going to explain that, like, okay, I'm just going to help you do some grounding and de-escalate a little bit here so we can have a more productive conversation. So I'm just going to ask you to take a nice deep breath in. And if you can hold that for just a little bit. And then if you can just send your breath out through pursed lips that you're going to just control with your lip muscles. Just like that. That's really good. You look like you've done this before.
Yes, once or twice, actually.
That's very good, yeah. So once I can see that you're a little bit calmer than when you first came in.
Shoulders drop.
I feel calmer. Sorry.
And then I'm just going to say, so what brings you in today? Right. What happened? And that's what we call a precipitating event. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say that to the client. But yeah, just because that'll tell me a lot right there. And then I'm watching really closely for the way they say it. If they're looking at me, if they're looking away, I write down a lot when I'm in session with somebody, because the words that people use really matter to me, and I'll circle back to them later. I'll go, so earlier you used the word frantic. Let's explore that. What was that like for you? And I'll bring them back to the memory that they were sharing, or the event, or what made them use the word frantic is what I'm curious about, right? Versus, I was scared, or, you know, there are certain times when I call it, I'll pin something, you know, to come back to later.
Right.
So I do take a lot of notes in sessions, and sometimes we don't even revisit things in that particular session. Sometimes it'll be later on, I'll go, you know, the last time we were talking about this with you were talking about when you were in eighth grade and you had that experience in the classroom, and it's really interesting because the last time you talked about it, you shared it in this context, but now I'm hearing you share it and it's got a little bit different perspective. So let's talk about what shifted there, if you could share that with me, you know? So I do take a lot of notes. It's really helpful. Mm-hmm. And sometimes for people to be able to see, you know, their own cognitive dissonance or whatever it is really, really helpful. So I feel like if I'm addicted to anything, it's note taking. It's definitely and it has been really helpful.
I don't think anyone's ever died from that. Maybe got a good case of writer's cramp or carpal tunnel.
This just reminds me why I need to learn to journal, because, you know, a lot of people that I know, healthy people in my life, they journal. And I just haven't gotten into a good groove of that, because I like what you were sharing about, like, the wording and, you know, I think that when people do that, then they can look back at the year and their life and they see different things and they learn from it. And could just be really positive, but I've never really been much of a journaler.
It's interesting, Denise, because earlier, I think it was before Johnny turned on everything, I think we were off air, but you were sharing how you had kind of caught yourself in an awareness moment, you know, and so that's what mindfulness tools are all about, is kind of catching ourselves. And so journaling at the end of the day is just a fantastic mindfulness exercise. It's, I had that experience with so-and-so, and now that I think about it, I probably could have shown up better in that moment. And then gradually you end up, you kind of end up slowing down time so that you are in the moment and almost kind of proactive with yourself. Mm-hmm. But journaling is just excellent. I encourage all my clients have journaling for homework. They don't all it every time, but it definitely is their homework. And then sometimes they'll bring it in and go, I had this major breakthrough. Can we talk about this? And that's that for a therapist. That's like, get the confetti. You know,
there's balloons falling from the ceiling and stuff in your mind, probably like, the confetti's falling. Exactly. Oh my gosh, that's so great.
Because the insights really, the most powerful insights come from the client. If I sit here pulling, dragging insights out of going, I think that it doesn't mean as much. So I call my therapy, and maybe this is because I'm from Montana and Glacier National Park is right outside my dining room, but I move glacially slowly with clients. It is a very, very slow process, and it does start with grounding, mind-body work. We call it bottom-up versus top-down, which would be the cognitive, when you start up here, when you start in the cognitive, and then you get down into accessing feelings and stuff. I start with feelings first because a lot of our clients and a lot of people with substance use disorders, a lot of times are disconnected from their bodies. Their feelings are not accessible to them. So if we can just start with some breath work and just start with some mind-body awareness and exercise, we're going to just sit in our chair here. And I just want you to feel what it feels like. Where are your feet touching the floor? And what does that feel like? Like right now, my big toes are the only things touching the floor. But what does that feel like right there, that sensation? And then let's just move up the body. And we'll do kind of like a body scan like that. And just get people more comfortable with just being with themselves and not having to disconnect all the time. Because a lot of times that's what the substance use has done for them, is help them to disconnect. Mm-hmm. So,
It's fascinating you say that. Denise was sharing with me when she was having a family crisis. Family member was in crisis. And you did this exercise where you just looked around the room and named things in the room de-escalate that panic feeling.
Yeah, I've done that myself. And then I walked my mom through it as she was having a stroke while we were waiting for the paramedics. And it helps. And because she just kept shaking and crying, and she thought she was going to die. And I was just like, Mom, and I realized she couldn't see very far. I'm like, okay, I want you to look at my face. I want you to look at my curly hair. I want you to look at the color of my eyes.
That's an excellent exercise.
Now, look at the shape of my face. Yes. And I tell you, it was just amazing how much she was able to calm down and just relax more, even in the middle of seizures. Of strokes,
Yes.
And we've done it for seizures, too, because she's had those. Those have been her most recent.
That's very powerful.
I mean, she was so scared.
Yes. Well, and looking into...
I didn't know what else to do.
Right. No, you did exactly the right thing.
You literally did a prescribed therapy. Looking into a loved one's eyes, a therapist, can do that with their client, but the therapist, try to develop a really good therapeutic relationship, and you might be the only, quote-unquote, loved one, I'm using that loosely, in their lives, literally, when they're coming in. But you're her daughter, so that's really, really powerful. And that eye contact, the mirroring, is so wonderful that you knew to do that.
Thanks.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. That's actually a really good point. I think, when I came into recovery just shy of 8 years ago, my counselor, Elizabeth, at Weeks and Vitri, was just really so life-changing from me. I mean, she was just like the first person that like started to talk with me, and I started to get some understanding of what was going on with myself, and boy, it just made such a difference. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you really are, for people, sometimes the only person that they get to talk to. I mean, my family loved me and everything, but I wasn't connected in having these conversations, and they didn't understand.
Right.
And my little girls were little, mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just, I think the word would be invaluable. I mean, it's just so important.
And sometimes you literally are, as a therapist, you literally are reparenting the person through some of the, these are literally neurological changes that are taking place in their brain. Because the brain has so adapted itself to trauma that it's maladaptive for anything but survival mode. So you are really literally physically helping change the brain. And it's a process of the therapist is actually doing some reparenting. But what you're really doing is you're modeling for the client how to reparent themselves. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, you know, you had a therapist at Weeks in Vitri that understood that and was modeling that for you.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
It was very cool. And yeah, and being in trauma mode, life looks, it feels and seems so much different than it does today.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I feel like, you know, like the lens of looking out into the world was completely different as, you know, when I was using an active addiction and when I came in fresh, you know, into recovery. It's just, it was so much different.
How does it feel today?
It feels a lot more peaceful and relaxing.
Beautiful.
I mean, there's still moments where it's like, oh, I need to get this done. But it's not like a, like I can catch myself. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, well, I just need to, you know what I mean? Oh, it's just, that's so nice.
It's yay. So,
I love so it. Nice. I don't know how I ever lived like that before. This is just so nice.
Emotional freedom. Mm. That's just great. I love
very,
to see that.
It's just so much freedom.
I found myself on top of not being able to stop drinking, I found myself not to be able to stop all kinds of other behaviors as well. Lying, of course, that was a necessity, you know, during my addiction because I had to cover it up, right? Which in retrospect, I know did not happen. There were other things. I would start doing a project. Bearing in mind, I'm drunk this whole time, varying levels of drunk. And I would just be hitting my head against the wall trying to get this widget to fit in the whatchamacallit. And I wasn't able to stop and step back and think differently about what I was doing to see if is there some other way I can do this that would be easier. I just, the feeling that I should be able to do it the way I'm trying, even though I'm failing and failing and failing. You know, it was the most amazing thing. And now, in sobriety, when I hit that wall, I can go, well, wait a minute. I'm either doing something wrong, or maybe I just need to step away from it for a couple of minutes. And then I can actually do that and then come back to it. And same thing with a thought process. I'm sitting down trying to write out a script, and I can look at it and go, oh, wow, man, I'm really getting too detailed here. This really isn't necessary. Let's restart with that thought in mind and keep that going throughout writing it. I mean, these things used to be, I'm holding a script. You can't see it on the radio. But these things at times were like 2 and 3 pages long, totally unnecessary. We did a recording last night with our director, and I had it all laid out in a couple of pages. I thought I had it pared down. And God bless Daryl. He's more of a stream of consciousness guy and doesn't follow a script very well. So we were bouncing back and forth. And I realized at the time, I mean, I hadn't done anything wrong. I did what I thought, you know, typically what I do when we do interviews. But it just didn't work in that case. And fortunately, even Denise, who was as we say, walking on her lips from being so busy all day
so
long.
Tired.
She hadn't had dinner. She had to put antifreeze in her rig before she came over. She's chasing kids around at soccer. And, you know,
truly.
So and I should have known that we're both good enough to be able to adapt to that and work through it. And we worked through it. And
it came out
fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, just that ability to, you know, be where your hands are is what I like to say. And then look at something and go, oh, wait, no. Time to back up a little bit.
I like that expression, be where your hands are.
I heard it, like a lot of things, in AA meetings. Nothing against professional counselors, but I probably learned more about myself in AA than I did with professional counselors.
Mm-hmm.
At least in regards to my addiction, but my addiction was my entire life. You know, I started drinking early, wasn't always a daily drinker, but at the end, basically, I was just living to drink. Going into AA, you know, having the advantage of dealing with people who had had that same life experience and had found a way out, I was able to learn from them how to make the changes I needed to make. They said, it's a simple program, really. You just need to not drink and change everything.
Simple.
Simple.
That's so interesting listening to you talk about AA, Johnny. I just gave a client an article yesterday, and it's on the epigenetics of how and why AA works. I think it's called The Neurobiology of 12-Step Fellowship or something. It's a research article. Mm-hmm. It's, you know,
I want to read it now.
I will find it.
But it's like, it's legit a thing. Like, it works.
It literally mm-hmm. changes the brain. And again, it has to do with the safety that we were talking about. You know, like you said, when you run into people, you don't have to just say fine. You can actually talk about how your day is going.
Right, right.
So cool.
So great.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing I think if I was going to pin down, and I want to hear more of the things that you want to share, because I'm fascinated with what you're sharing, Colleen. Okay. But I just want to say real quick, you know, some of the things that I was missing throughout my life was, you know, like community and close friends and people I could talk to and female friends. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of my codependency, or whatever you want to call it, was just all about like the boyfriend, you mm-hmm. know, and I didn't have the female friends, and there was just this imbalance in a lot of areas. And now in recovery, I mean, I have all those things. Mm-hmm. I've wanted these things since I was a child. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm super social. You know, no wonder it all went wrong. Little Denise was like, I need friends. I need people. I need to talk. I need to hear you talk. Let's share, you know?
Right.
Seriously.
No,
anyways,
I don't.
Sorry. You're like, no, I really like, don't know.
I need somebody to punch.
I know. What's with that?
Well, our bonding methods are different. Let's just put it that
totally
way.
I'll just leave it there.
Yes. You're just reminding me. I'm reading that book right now, Chasing the Scream, Johann Hari. It's about the war on drugs. And I was taking a walk after reading part of it, and this, what would you call it, a motto came to me, or like a bumper sticker or something. The war on, because the book's about the war on drugs, and all kinds, it's following all different people's life scenarios. I thought, you know, the war on drugs, it begins around the kitchen table, because that's where you learn relationship skills, right? I mean, if you think about it, if people actually sat down to a kitchen table and asked each other how about their day, that's where you learn to start doing that. And, you know, somebody says fine, and then mom and dad circle back around to that one and go, okay, so remember, fine's not going to work if you want dessert or whatever. I mean, they do whatever they do. But, but I mean, teaching kids, learning relational skills begins literally as soon as you're born almost. You know, you're so cute that everybody's just oohing and aahing over you, and that's the proper position for a baby. But then going from that to proper relationship skills, the reciprocity, the serve and return, they call it, the giving and the taking. And, you know, you learn that with your parents and your siblings, and then you do it with your friends, and then you do it with significant others and work people and so forth. But if we don't have kitchen tables where people sit around and learn those skills, is it any wonder there is so much codependency or seeking relationships and substances, because we don't know how to have them with people? Yeah. Or gaming, you know, so many things that are just, as long as I don't have to interact with another human being, because that is too painful, you know.
That's interesting. You
brought up Johann Hari, because we had a listener out here in Moscow. She asked about that author. She had read the book. And her question, I'm going to paraphrase, was, does the recovery center understand his concept of addiction actually begins before a person ever really picks up, based on the fact that people don't understand them? And she was like wondering what sort of process or program we have here to deal with that sort of thing. So it sounds to me like you are the process.
Well, like
to
I
deal
said earlier,
with that, you know, understanding, because you just explained, I think, what he meant by that.
Yeah.
Learning, you know, the kitchen table, learning.
Exactly. Yeah, relationship, you know, skills. Yeah, because, yeah, but also really just more people having a trauma-informed lens. You know, that doesn't have to just be a counselor. It can be anybody who just understands mm-hmm. that people really are showing up the best they can. And that doesn't mean to enable. It doesn't. You definitely have to have your boundaries.
I was going to say, still have boundaries.
You
still,
betcha.
Yeah.
You,
yeah, that's super important.
Absolutely. But I think it's like Mother Teresa said, people will be unkind, be kind anyway. And I want to append that with, but have boundaries, or and have boundaries, right, or something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so still, you know, because mm-hmm. enabling isn't helping anybody either. So meeting them compassionately where they're at doesn't necessarily mean giving them the maladaptive coping device that they might want at that particular moment either.
And would you say that as a person is doing that, just assuming, you know, and looking at it like someone is doing the best that they can, the lens that you're talking about, trauma-informed lens, mm-hmm. that as someone does that with someone else, over time, would you say it gets easier?
Yes, I think it's the over time. I think that's the piece right there. And I think that the patience, and I got to bring humility up again, just realizing this might not happen on my watch. I'm just going to show up the best I can for this person right now. Sure. But hopefully more people will do that for them. It doesn't mean making somebody your project. Yeah, time. It takes a lot. That's why I move glacially slowly. Mm-hmm. Things need to be processed. There's a lot of work going on with the neurosystem. So I try to model people having patience with themselves, too. Mm-hmm. Having patience with others, having patience with yourself. Yeah, because it's absolutely a process. It takes time. Absolutely. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Here's something I run into a lot, and maybe this relates to the topic a little bit. A lot of times, I know I realized in my depression, I actually took one of those online tests, you know, that WebMD puts out. And when I got done with it, it literally said, call the suicide hotline. That's how deep I was in it. But the idea of depression, despite the fact that I thought I was, you know, fairly aware of like symptoms and whatnot, I was painfully unaware. I mean, I suppose there's a difference from just having a blue day, just a bad day, your dog got hit by a car, and you're sad. And that's probably the right feeling to have, you know, when you lose a pet, you know, an old friend from way back. But when you just seem to be in what I would call a funk for a long time, and you just don't know why, and you're carrying on about your life, and somebody comes up to you and suggests, hey, you may be suffering with depression, would a person who maybe got that information be wise to like come down to the recovery center and say, I don't know what's going on mm-hmm. with me?
Yeah, absolutely. Just right there, taking that act of kindness towards yourself, that act of self-care to go, well, I'm just going to at least go investigate this, mm-hmm. you know, go to make a doctor's appointment, come into the recovery center. Yeah, talk to a professional who can help you with that. Yes.
Yeah, that kind of, as you were asking that, I was thinking, you know, are there some things that you'd like to share that are like good reasons or like that would be good to stop in and make an appointment with you?
Well, certainly when you, any situation like you just described, Johnny, whether somebody brings it to your attention or whether you're, you know, taking a survey on the internet or something, and it's, you know, it's as red flagged as yours was. It really is a loving thing to do when people can lovingly bring it to somebody's attention in such a way that the person does actually want to go and you know, seek out some help. So yes, if somebody brings it to your attention, but if just your own self-awareness, certainly the suicide awareness, you know, that's what the signs are about this month.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so when you're thinking about taking your life, certainly, yeah, please come in here. That's what the absolutely crisis center is all about. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And then we'll find out what's going on. Yeah.
Are there some more subtle things? I mean, I'm a guy, so guys typically don't do anything until it's crisis time, right?
Right.
Right. You know, if it's only bleeding a little, I'll slap some duct tape on it. You know, but if I can see through to the bone, I'll slap some duct tape on it and look at it in an hour, and then maybe.
And then
go
you might
get
pass
stitches.
Out.
Yeah.
And right. then your wife wakes you up, and you're like, "Oh, maybe I should have."
Right. Exactly. Exactly. What are some of the more subtle things that you know? What that somebody might you know hear today and say, maybe it's worth investigation.
Yeah.
Maybe I should.
Yeah. Good question.
Find out more about this.
Yeah. So there's actually a clinical term. This is what antidepressants help with. It's called anhedonia, and that's an inability to find joy. So you look around, everybody else is having a good time at your son's baseball game or Thanksgiving or whatever it is, and you just can't find the joy in that. That's a really good sign that you need to talk to somebody. Anhedonia is very serious. And it's because antidepressants can help with that, why not, right? So that's one thing. Avoidance, if you just find yourself in avoidance mode. And so what would you guys, if you could think of an avoidance tactic, what are some of the things that would come to your mind right now?
Things that we do to avoid?
Yeah, to avoid emotional closeness especially.
Okay, so, you know, continuing just work. Mm-hmm. Just, oh, yeah. I have to do this until yep. the minute I go to sleep. And then the minute that I wake up, work. That would be one. I think that, honestly, it's probably pretty common in society.
It is. And because it's accepted.
It's totally, I mean, it's praised.
It's praised.
It's like, oh, good job, and oh, thanks for staying late. And
yes.
then you don't have to go home and deal with your family or your
yes.
spouse. And
yes.
you can just hide out at work, and it pays you.
It's
in multiple ways. Yeah.
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 Yes.
You get the praise from the boss, and then you get the, yeah, and the oh, paycheck yeah. is big, and.
And you're avoiding what you're avoiding.
Right.
Whatever
exactly.
that may be. Sure.
Exactly. I can remember, well, this is experience from my drinking days. I don't tend to avoid things now. I tend to just kind of lean into them and see what I can preen out of it, either for education or joy or, you know, whatever. But I would use the either I'm not feeling well or oh that sort of thing is just not my bag and I just you know don't want to do it. Whether that was true or not, I mean it would just I could come up with a million excuses and most of them were centered around the fact of I'm not going to be able to drink while I'm doing that.
So it's like excuses or isolation to like
right.
not be around people
right.
so that, yeah, for mm-hmm. whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes, you know, if you're struggling with something and you're doing things like substances or drinking too much, your friends are going to be like, you know, are you okay? If you're falling down, you're...
Right.
Those kinds of things.
Right.
Or your
and,
wife's concerned or, I don't know,
and
your spouse,
and given
your kids.
Enough time, they, you know, there are those people who will just go, nah. So, I'm not going to invite him. He never shows up. Or I'm not going to ask him to help because he says he's coming and he doesn't. Mm-hmm. He never shows up.
So what?
Yeah, those isolating behaviors are definitely a red flag. Yes. Mm-hmm. If I would lean into a situation like that for sure and find out about that. You know, I would say don't be afraid to offend. You know, just kind of go there and hey, I've noticed you've been really needing a lot of time to yourself lately. What's going on? Mm-hmm. You know, and kind maybe even kind of put it that way. Not I've noticed you're trying to get out of everything. rather,
everything's no.
Yeah, right. So yeah, that's definitely one, Johnny. And just that, you know, not even being able to get out of bed.
That's
is
what I was going
to
say. Can the mind like
major,
sleeping so much?
Right? Yeah. And especially, you know, people, I'm already hearing people going, oh, winter's coming. There's already the anxiety about winter coming and the shortened days and the, you know, difficulty getting out and about or just the gloominess that some people feel when it's cloudy more often. So, and there's a certain amount of that you can have your coping devices and your self-care, and it can bother you, but you can be okay. But if you're not coping with it well, then you might have something that can be helped by therapy by just, you know, visiting with a counselor about that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or possibly even antidepressants, so which, you know, counselors can't prescribe, but then we would just refer you to the doctor for that. So.
All right.
And then a lot of times I mention the word anxiety because a lot of times depression and anxiety, you know, they go back and forth. So that the hamster wheels that just how many hamster wheels can I fit in my head, you know? And that's another tool of distraction, you know? So sometimes the question to ask yourself when you've got the constant hamster wheel thing going on is, can we just press pause on this for a little second and go, what is it that I'm saying press pause on my hamster wheels. Ask him to, guys, get off the wheels for a second. I ask myself a question. And
it's a lunch break.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder what it is that I'm trying to avoid that I am just unable to focus on anything because I've got so many ruminating thoughts going on. A lot of times that's actually an avoidance tactic. And you guys are familiar with Gabor Mate, take it? He wrote In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, which Daryl's a big fan of that book. I just love Gabor Mate. He has tons of helpful videos on YouTube about how attachment disorders in childhood lead to addictions, something we were kind of talking about earlier. He also has an excellent book called Scattered Minds about ADD. He doesn't always put the H in there. You can ADHD, ADD, it's just one's with the hyperactivity, one's not. But still, it's the inability to focus. And he ties that in with trauma and how the brain just wants to keep kind of taking these little mini little sideways vacations because I don't want to face this extremely painful issue. Excellent, excellent place to come in for therapy. All kinds of tools for that.
Right.
Yeah.
Just speaking
and,
my
and
language.
And I want to throw one thing out here. Having you refer to antidepressants, mm-hmm. and I think there's basically two schools of thought on that from the patient side.
Mm-hmm.
And one is, it can be useful and it can help me. And the other one is, I'm going to be stuck on these things for the rest of my life. Let me share something with you. I went on antidepressants for probably a period of about 4 or 5 years. And it turns out a lot of my depression was associated with my work environment.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left that work environment, within 6 months, I started feeling differently. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say better, but it was differently.
Mm-hmm.
I have many more positive thoughts than negative thoughts. And I had been on this medication for a long time,
mm-hmm.
at the same dosage. So I talked to my MD, mm-hmm. and I said, can I get off of these? And they said, absolutely you can.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll taper you off.
Yes.
Slowly. The work's on the patient side.
Mm-hmm.
You got to know, keep track of where your head's at, so to speak. And over a period of time, I was able to taper off of them. And not that I don't have depressive thoughts now, but I rarely do, and I don't take the medication anymore.
Yeah, I am not a big fan of medication when it's not necessary, that's for sure. And a lot of times, some medications will just help people get over a certain hump.
Right.
You know, things that they're dealing with, but I completely respect people who don't want to be on whatever it is they're taking. So sometimes the therapy can help with some of those automatic thoughts that people have that lead to their depression or anxiety. And so we can still tackle things in the counseling therapeutic sense at the same time as the medication is doing whatever it's doing. And then when the person is ready to have that conversation with their doctor, I think it's awesome.
Well, for me, it was, I wasn't just taking the medication. I mean, firm believer in the medication is a piece of the puzzle,
mm-hmm.
but the therapy,
right,
the cognitive therapy I was doing was the other big piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I had my little third piece, which is, my AA group and things I do there.
Absolutely.
Which also helped me. So it wasn't that I just went, I want to get off of this,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't seem to help, or I'm still feeling depressed and I just want off. It was because I'm progressing and I think I can live life without this because I think now I have the tools to deal with those things.
Good point.
And I've also removed myself from an environment that was, use the term, toxic,
mm-hmm.
Or at least, in my head, it was.
Mm-hmm. That's what you needed to
do. And now things are different, so let's try and and change things a little bit.
Right.
And that was more of what it was.
Yes.
You know, I have a very close friend who's has schizoaffective disorder, and he needs to be on medication, or he starts doing some really unhealthy behaviors. And, you know, he is aware that he probably will need to take that the rest of his life.
Right. And these are different, you know, these are different scenarios. And even people with depression, the depression can have a different root and source too.
Right.
You know, so depending upon, and that's why the MD, you know, has been to school for a long time. And, you know.
They do.
Exactly.
So, but yes, I completely agree with you about the multiple modalities. So you had some medication, you had some counseling, you had AA, you decide to make a change in your work environment. You know, it's, you, I don't think it's ever a good idea to just throw a pill at something and think your depression or anything is going to go away. No.
Well, and that's why, you know, had I realized what was going on, because I didn't start the counseling until after the medication, mainly because I couldn't get into a counselor like I was talking about earlier. If I'd had my druthers, I would have rather gone start doing counseling and then assess the need for the medication, you know, after that. I mean, that's the way I would have gone at it at that point.
Yeah. I do have some clients who have issues that in many cases somebody would be prescribed meds for, and for whatever reasons they are just adamantly against it. And I go, that's okay. You know, let's just do. Yeah, it's just really every person is different. And you know, a lot of times we see here, it kind of goes along with, a lot of times it goes along with a long history of substance use, but we see people who are really kind of struggling between the pre-contemplation and the contemplation, you know, in the stages of change part there. So that's why I like to go really, really slowly. I don't push anybody past their comfort zone. You don't want to be on meds? No problem. We're just, I mean, unless they do have something in the, if they need antipsychotics or something like that, then I definitely encourage them to do what the doctor prescribed. Sometimes I have to really put my foot down about that. But depending upon what it is, yeah, I absolutely work with people where they're at and move at their pace. You know, move at their pace. So that usually means not trying to, so back to the original, what's the difference between a trauma-informed lens and trauma counseling? So trauma counseling, from my perspective, is something that needs to go slowly. You really need to have respect for why the brain chose to repress memories. It was to protect the person. So you don't go getting a pickaxe out, you know, there is a reason that those things are buried. And so I do what I call fence building first, lots and lots and lots of resourcing and fence building for the person first. And then at their pace, when they're ready to process what's at the root of their addictions or their behaviors or et cetera, both, then we do, I just got certified from the International Institute for EMDR. So that was a long couple months process, and it's a really, really good training. It's such a powerful therapy that it's you really need to have a lot of respect for the power of that process.
Yeah, EMDR is,
it's an eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Right.
So
I have heard of that, and actually the person that held your position here prior wanted to come on and talk about that, and we just never made the connection, timing issues. But you know what? I would love to talk about that with you in another episode.
Okay.
Because we are just about up against the clock here. And time has bummer.
I just got to say that the Recovery Center is just really lucky to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm very really valuable to the team, and this is just, I'm
very blessed to be here. Thank you, Denise.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Well, even beyond the Recovery Center, this community
is
really lucky to have you here. Like I said, you know, the availability of counseling is raw, even if you have unlimited funds and insurance, just being able to see someone. And you know, people who are in addiction or who are in recovery typically don't have a lot of funds or options.
Right.
So having you here is just a blessing to this entire community. And I hope you get slammed after this thing.
Well, the tragic part is I almost don't have many slots left in my schedule right now. Mm-hmm. But I do try to help people find someone else in the community. We mm-hmm. do have two new therapists who just came to the community. So, yes. So I do everything I can to help.
Right. Fabulous. Well, thank you again, Colleen. Wonderful having you here. And Denise, thank you.
Thank you, Johnny.
We managed to pull this off again with...
Once again, too, within 24 hours.
Yeah, a few casualties and right? only the occasional misstep. So perfect. Well, we're going to close it out for now then. And we're going to close with the usual. You know, if you think you have a problem with drugs or alcohol or mental health issues, you do.
Please tell us why you had to hide away for so long.